I invite you to turn this morning with me to Genesis chapter 9. And we'll look at the end of this chapter together this morning. A very curious story that almost seems out of place in the context of what we've seen so far. Over the last 3.5 chapters, we've seen how Noah is a man in all appearances exemplary in his righteousness, in his faith, in his obedience to God to do the seemingly impossible or unimaginable, to pursue God and to pursue God's means of appointed salvation. And then this passage that we almost seemingly collide into shakes us and helps us relate to this man that I think at other times seems beyond us. So let's look at this together. Genesis 9, begin our reading in verse 18. And you'll see why I describe this passage this way. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the people of the whole earth were dispersed. Noah began to be a man of the soil, and he planted a vineyard. He drank of the wine and became drunk, and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, and told his brothers outside. Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness. When Noah woke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan, and a servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. May God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. This is God's word. What happened to Noah? What went so terribly wrong between the man that the Apostle Peter describes as a preacher of righteousness and what we read here this morning? Passed out drunk. What happened? Let me say at the outset that it's passages like this one that have convinced me of the absolute necessity of being Christ-centered in our worldview. And even being Christ-centered in particular as we read the stories of the Old Testament. That's why right now no one is down in our kids' church or our preschool telling those children to be like Noah. Because Noah at his best was not what God desired. That's why we teach, even to our little ones, that the hero of the Old Testament, the hero of all of Scripture, is not men like Shem and Japheth and Noah and David and Abraham, but the hero of the Old Testament is God. I also like passages like this in a weird sort of way, and let me tell you why. Because I think without passages like this, we would set people like Noah up on a pedestal and almost worship them and think to ourselves, we can never be like them, so what's the use of even trying to obey God or try to please God? And what we find in a passage like this is that Noah is actually a lot like us. This passage here in verse 20 begins with the words, "Noah began to be a man of the soil." And I think as Moses is writing this, there's an intended double meaning in what Moses is writing here. Yes, he was a man of the soil. He planted a vineyard. He grew crops. That's how he lived after the flood, because no one else was out there in his culture to do these things for him. But also, the words very literally are, Noah began to be a man of the dust. We read this morning that passage from Psalm 103 in our worship, that God remembers our frame, how we're constituted, that we're just dust. And this really brings Noah down from this man of righteousness, this preacher of righteousness, who built a floating box for 100 years of his life because he so confidently believed in God's means of salvation that he was willing to obey to that radical degree. And he brings him down to our level where we realize Noah's just a guy. Like Adam, he's formed from the dust of the ground. Like Adam, like us, he struggles with his own flesh. So Noah's salvation was not found in Noah, and our salvation is not found in being like Noah. So let's unpack these few verses and let's see how it relates what Noah experienced and what his sons experienced to something that realistically you and I experience every single week of our lives. And let's see also how this passage points very clearly to salvation in Christ. So first of all, what was Noah's sin? You know, Noah wastes no time after the flood proving to us that just by getting rid of the sin out there does not make us holy people, because we can get rid of the sin out there and never get rid of the sin in here. And as God brings Noah through this flood and saves him and delivers him, I've said this before, but from everything we know, there are only 8 people on the face of the earth exiting that ark, and I think they're all worshipers of God. The culture around them that would tempt them and try them and test their faith and their obedience is gone. They have the opportunity of renewing culture, and yet they're still people of the ground in a spiritual sense. So, Noah plants this vineyard. He cultivated grapes, apparently. He made a beverage from those grapes. He drank the beverage of those grapes. And I'll say to you this morning that what the Bible's saying is that none of that was sinful. What was sinful is Noah became drunk. God is not jumping his case, and Moses, as he writes about this, is not faulting him for, in a sense, being a man of the soil and planting a crop and growing that and enjoying that to the glory of God. But Noah way overstepped the bounds of what God did give him to enjoy. And so he became intoxicated on this beverage that he had made. He handed the control of his thoughts and his desires and even his bodily actions, he handed the control of those things over to the alcohol. That's what drunkenness or intoxication is. People don't remember. People say and do things that maybe ordinarily they wouldn't say or do. And I want to generalize this, that Noah's sin was not just drunkenness or intoxication. Noah's sin, really, if we generalize it, is idolatry. Because that's what idolatry is. Idolatry is when we look to anything other than God to satisfy us, to make us happy, to make us feel relaxed, to get rid of a fear that we're struggling with or an anxiety. So the general category that Noah's drunkenness or intoxication goes into is really idolatry. And what I want you to see this morning is that all idolatry, no matter what your idols are just like Noah's drunkenness. Because you are saying to someone or something or even an ideology, I'm handing over control to you because I like what you do for me more than I rely on God. I've seen people that are ready to blame Noah for planting a vineyard. They say it's a slippery slope. You know, if you plant a vineyard, what are you going to do? It's going to grow grapes. What are you going to do with those grapes? I mean, in that culture, they didn't have refrigeration, so the grapes are going to ferment. You going to drink that? And they put it all together as if it's one thing. And let me be clear that the Bible doesn't do that. The Bible continually makes a distinction between, for example, the fruit of the vine and drunkenness. Just like the Bible makes a distinction between food and gluttony, or sleep and laziness, or sex and immorality. See, there are a lot of good things that God has given us as a part of His creation to enjoy in the right context. But these things can easily become idols where we take them out of the context or the limits by which God has blessed us to enjoy those things to His glory. We exaggerate them. We become drunk on them, either literally or figuratively. And that's why I want us to see that this applies to all of us. Because some of you look at this and you say, man, I've never been drunk with alcohol. I've never been intoxicated. I've never even drank this stuff. You will not be drunk if you never drink. That's a true statement. But what I want you to see is that you can be committing the sin of Noah even if you have that kind of position toward what Noah drank. There are things that each one of us finds intoxicating. What I kind of encourage you to do is listen and say, yeah, that's me. And maybe write a couple of these down. I didn't put these in your notes. Maybe some of you are intoxicated by a relationship. That relationship, desiring to please that person, is what satisfies you, what drives you, what keeps you up, what gets you up in the morning. you have to please that person. You have to impress them. You have to do things for them, or you have to get them to do things for you. And you are drunk with that relationship because you can't walk away from it, or you can't be pleased that just God is your God. Some of you are intoxicated with a materialistic lifestyle. You can never have too much or too big or too good of things. As soon as you get the 48-inch plasma, you realize somebody else has the 55-inch. And so you have to get the 60-inch. You're doing things like that because you are intoxicated with having bigger and better and nicer stuff. Clothes, stuff for your house, houses, cars. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with having those things, but there is something wrong to handing your affections over to a materialistic lifestyle where you always, always, always have to be out chasing the latest fashions or whatever. Some of you are intoxicated by success in your vocation. And you're a workaholic. You're drunk on work because you so much want to please other people and be perceived by others as being a successful businessman or woman. But you're so drunk on that success syndrome that you do to make people happy. Some of you are intoxicated by learning and knowledge and always having to be right. And it's such an intoxicating thing that you feel like you're right about everything. We used to kid this guy in our college class that you could bring up any topic in the world at random, and there was this kid right there, and he knew more about it than you did. Now, what everyone else sees that he doesn't see is that he doesn't really know what he thinks he knows. He's just talking. He's intoxicated with his own knowledge and learning and what he thinks he knows. Some of us are intoxicated by body image, and we exercise like crazy to maintain a body image. Or we eat or don't eat to maintain a body image. Or we spend all this time in front of the mirror because we're intoxicated with how other people view us. It's interesting dealing with anorexics or bulimics, how they view themselves. And probably some of you have seen maybe even like a Dateline, if you haven't personally dealt with someone like this, that when they look in the mirror, they can be skin and bones. And they look in the mirror and they see someone that's fat. They're intoxicated with body image. Sometimes we're intoxicated by our reputation or what other people think of us, and we're willing to do or say anything, even if it's not what we really believe or feel, so that you perceive of me the way I want you to. Some of us are intoxicated with ministry. Say, that's a strange one for a pastor to say, because typically aren't you trying to get people to serve and they're not? Well, that's true. But sometimes people view ministry as this thing that gives them what they want, recognition, a position. And you're intoxicated with ministry. You're not doing it to serve Christ the head by serving his body. You're doing it because you're intoxicated with what it does for you. Intoxicated by children. I mean, we have a community full of people like that. I just watch the decisions that parents make for their kids that are not good for their children, but they're intoxicated with just having to give their kids what they think is the best of everything. It's because the parents are intoxicated with their children. They give up church because their child's sleeping and nothing's more important than nap time. Some of us are intoxicated with entertainment. And understand, I don't have a position where it's inherently wrong to be entertained. God gave you all these things and said, have dominion over them. And there are a lot of things that you can enjoy for God's glory. I'm not saying you can't be entertained, because even the people who say that are being entertained. They just call it something else so it sounds more spiritual. But there are people that maybe don't go to that extreme, but you have an insatiable thirst, an insatiable appetite for more and more and more entertainment. And I'm not even saying it has to be bad entertainment, like immoral or something that defies God on its face. Just the fact that you're giving yourself to it, it's an idol. It could be wonderful entertainment. It could be the best classical music in the whole world, if that's your thing. I mean, something that nobody would say, well, that's immoral. And you have an insatiable appetite for it. It's your God. You're drunk with it. The compliments of others. Freedom and control. Things like food or sleep or relaxation. Things like anxiety and stress. Lustful thoughts or looks or arrogance or self-righteousness. All of these things are things that people here, including myself, are sometimes intoxicated by. We can't get enough of these things. I want to pause here and let you get real with each other that it shouldn't be so hard for us to relate with Noah. Because many of us have a lot of the advantages growing up that Noah, in a sense, had. And yet we read this passage and we say, man, what went wrong? How in the world could Noah do something like that? I would never... Really? Would you never? Because I would venture to guess that all of us, in some form or another, over the past week, if we even have to go back that far, have been intoxicated by something. And I'm speaking figuratively. That your emotions, your appetites, your desires, your thoughts, your fears, what you look to satisfy you, has been something other than God. And so I just want to get real and say, we're all idolaters just like Noah. And in a sense, we're drunk just like Noah. I want you to note here also, where did Noah's sin lead? It would be bad enough if he just got drunk and that was it. And we read Noah got drunk. But you see there in verse 21, he drank of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And what's going on there is that in this drunken stupor, Noah is exposing himself in a humiliating and shameful fashion. But again, I want to generalize that because I want to tell each of you, idols always expose our lives to shame. The anorexic is embarrassing herself or himself. She doesn't see it. She's bringing shame. If I could go right through all these things, the entertainment, the lust of compliments, the lust of sleep and relaxation and gluttony and all these things I've just listed off and many other things, they bring you to shame. They reduce your life to less than what it ought to be, living in the glory and the freedom of Christ. And I'll say again, idols always expose our lives to shame. Always. There isn't a single idol, even if it's something as pious sounding as self-righteousness. You know self-righteous people and you don't like to be around them because their behavior is shameful. Noah's drunkenness and exposure were literal. Ours often is figurative. But whatever that thing is that you look to for satisfaction other than God, whatever that thing that you fear rather than fearing God, whatever that thing that you want and are intoxicated by, it's blinding your perceptions of reality, just like the alcohol did to Noah. And it's opening your life and my life to unimaginable shame. You know why we should hate sin as believers, as a church, collectively? I mean, the world has the idea that we hate sin or we talk about hating sin because we think we're better than everybody else. There are a lot of ways where, in a sense, we're growing toward Christ. That's the process of sanctification. And so there is a sense in which you ought to, in your lifestyle and your thoughts and your desires, be growing to be more like Christ and less like the world. But the sad reality is we're a lot like everybody else. We ought to look at something like this and say, that's why I hate sin. Because sin is always idolatry, and idolatry always shames. It's very difficult to look at your own life and see, yeah, I see how this sin, I see how this idol is bringing me reproach and shame and embarrassment and humiliation. But you know what? Your friends see it. Your family sees it. People in your church see it that have gotten to know you a little bit. Because they're not intoxicated by the same thing you are. So I hate sin because it blinds people and it brings them shame. And I love God because God is the only one who can control us without humiliating us. Do you realize that? Everything else pretends to be God and it's really not. So it says, I promise if you love me, if you serve me, I'll give you this. And then it can't deliver the goods because it's not really what it says it is. And it brings you to shame by controlling you. God is the only God who can control us without humiliating us, without using that power over us as a leverage to humble us and bring us low. Most of you are probably familiar with the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Let me illustrate what I'm talking about here from the Lord of the Rings. One day there are two hobbits by the names of Deagle and Schmeagol, and they are celebrating Schmeagol's birthday. And for his birthday, he wants to go to the River Gladden and go fishing for whatever kind of fish exists in a fantasy world. Well, Deagle spots something in the water of that river as he's fishing. And as he goes in after it, he finds that it's this beautiful gold ring with this ornate carving on it. So he puts it on. And Shmuel sees that, and Shmuel says, "Well, I want that ring." And Deagle says, "Well, I found it. That's too bad." And Shmuel says, "Well, it's my birthday, so you should give it to me, because it's my birthday." And Deagle says, "Well, too bad. I found it." And what happens is Shmuel ends up strangling Deagle and taking the ring from him. Shmuel puts this ring on, and immediately he becomes intoxicated by its power, seducing his thoughts and his desires to make him think it's doing something positive for him. It's serving him, when in reality, he's serving the ring. It's called the ruling ring. Well, by the time we meet Shmuel, he's not called Shmuel. He's called Gollum. He's a hideous, grotesque creature. Gollum. He's named after a disgusting gurgling noise that comes out of his throat when he tries to talk. Shmuel calls, or Gollum calls that ring, "My precious." My precious. His "my precious" has reduced him to nothing. And you look at him and he's a hideous and grotesque creature because he thought he controlled that idol, when in fact that idol controlled him and reduced him to that grotesque, sickly, external creature who had a grotesque and sickly heart. And I use that to say that each of us should see ourselves in Gollum, because there are things that we grasp onto so tightly and say, "This is my precious. This is what I serve. This is what I love. This is what satisfies me. This is what I fear," rather than fearing God. And it's doing the same thing to us that that ring did to Shmuel. Because again, by the time we encounter Shmuel, who's Gollum now, he doesn't look like a hobbit. Not even in the cartoon version. So again, I don't want us to say, "Man, I can't relate to Noah. I can't relate to his sin. I can't relate to Gollum. I can't relate to his sin." The fact of the matter is, we should all be sitting here this morning saying, "Yeah, that's me." So that's Noah's sin. That's where Noah's sin led him. And I want to look in closing, how did Noah's sons respond to this sinful exposure? Because what you see in Noah's sons is a characterization of really the only two ways that you can respond to someone else's sin. There's a natural response. That's going to be characterized by what Ham did in his reaction. And then there's what I'm going to call a Christian response, like what Shem and Japheth did. The natural response, look at verse 22 with me. "And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his brothers outside." Now, the English makes that sound like a pretty benign incident, doesn't it? You think, well, he went in, he saw it, he went out and told his brothers. And that's the problem with translating one language into another. Because beginning here, when Ham goes into that tent, he didn't just see it and turn away, realizing the shamefulness of it. The word that's used here is literally, he looked upon it. He gazed intently at it. He gave his thoughts to it. He gave attention to it. And what's being conveyed here in the Hebrew language is that there's some kind of sick pleasure that's going on in Ham's mind as he looks upon the shame of his own father. The natural way is to enjoy the sin of other people. I don't know if Ham was enjoying the sin and the shame of his father in a lustful sort of way or a scornful sort of way. I would tend to believe it's a scornful sort of way. He's seeing his father naked. He knows of his father's faith and righteousness. And he enjoys the shameful exposure of his father because he enjoys scorning the one that God has called him to honor. But Ham didn't just enjoy the shameful exposure of his father. He also used that sin and that exposure as an opportunity to exploit his father. And again, the English doesn't communicate this very well. But as he goes outside and tells his brother, that's not the normal word for just telling someone in conversation. It's literally, he published. He made conspicuous. He's going out there and maybe laughing and saying, "You guys have got to go in and see." You see? And he's exploiting his father's shame. And let me be clear that this is a wicked response. When you see the sin of other people, how do you respond? And if you're honest with yourself, I mean, I'm not necessarily talking about physical nakedness, because there are a million sins that we could commit and a million sins that interact with your life as you see it in others. But there are ways in which we see the sin of other people and we want to take it in. We want to almost experience things vicariously because we can't be there with that woman, or we can't be there hearing that or getting that kind of money from doing that. So we enjoy things that other people are doing rather than turning away from them. We use that to exploit other people. Rather than forgiving, we use that to store that thought. And very often later, we pull that up to exploit them even further and bring them further shame than what they experienced in the initial sin. As Moses writes about this, he's pretty clear about where this natural response to other sin leads. In verse 25, Noah says to his son, "Cursed be Canaan. A servant of servants shall he be to his brothers." And this kind of response to sin will always bring you into servitude to others. And what you'll note is that Noah did not directly curse Ham. He cursed Ham's son, Canaan. Ham had come in and scorned his father. And you'll find out before you read too much further into Leviticus and Deuteronomy that Canaan, the person, becomes the father of the Canaanites, who are the people dwelling in the Promised Land when Israel goes up to occupy it. And if the Canaanites are any indication, Canaan took his father's sin regarding sexuality and lust and promiscuity and took it to a whole new level. And nakedness and exposure and immorality were just the norm in the Canaanite culture. It all goes back to this incident. They were cursed. He saw the sin of someone else and he exploited it. He enjoyed it. And then God turns right around and those people and their offspring are shamed. They're written forever in the Word of God as being a shameful people. So Ham's response, the natural response, is to enjoy and exploit the sins of others. And then the Christian response, this is illustrated by Japheth and Shem, verse 23. "Then Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it on both their shoulders, and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father. Their faces were turned backward, and they did not see their father's nakedness." The Christian response is that they had no desire to enjoy the sin of their father. They had no desire to exploit the shame of their father. The passage isn't literally saying that they didn't see their father at all, but it's using the same term. They didn't look at their father. They didn't enjoy it. They took a garment, and between the two of them, they backed into the room and covered him so they weren't exploiting the shame of their father, whom they were called by God to honor and to obey. What I want you to see in this is that the Christian response is always to cover the shame of another person. I want to be clear. I'm not talking about being an accessory to a crime, that someone has done something wrong and you help them cover it up so that they don't get punished. That's different than what's going on here. The idea here is a forgiving kind of covering. We're saying, I'm not going to enjoy this. I'm not going to exploit it. I'm going to cover it so that you are not further shamed than what you already have been. Now, as the Hebrew people are going into the Promised Land and Moses is writing these words for them, let me put this in the perspective of how they would have viewed this passage. At the end of this passage that we read, Noah blesses Shem, verse 26, and says Canaan will be his servant. You know who the Hebrew people are descendants of? They're descendants not of Ham, not of Japheth, but of Shem. And when God says through Noah, I'm going to bless these people, again, he's doing what we've seen him do all along, where he's calling a people to himself and he's setting them apart for special blessing by grace, by mercy, by his love. And now as these people go to enter the Promised Land, God has already promised them, Canaan and the Canaanites will serve you. You don't have to fear them. You don't have to avoid them. They're a cursed people because of their sin. And you are a blessed people because of your faith in God, a faith that illustrates the covering that Christ would later bring to our sin. Now, what about Japheth? It's interesting that Noah doesn't bless Japheth in the same way. He says, may God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem. In other words, the Gentiles would be blessed by living in the tents of the Hebrew people. You'll see a little bit more about that in just a moment. You've seen the sin. You've seen the response. How do we apply this? First of all, the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ, means that Christ has broken the intoxicating power of sin in your life. Your hope of salvation is not that you can go to God and tell Him, I'm not like Noah. I've never exposed myself in such a shameful way. Because you know what? It may not be drunkenness and it may not be literal nakedness, but we are all naked and open before the eyes of Him with whom we have to do. God sees your shame. So your hope is not going to Him and saying, I'm not like Noah and I'm not like Gollum. I'm very different. I'm better. Your hope is that God does remember your frame, that you are dust, and that God is prepared for you on the cross of Christ to break the intoxication of sin, where you no longer desire it and have an appetite for it the way that you did before. Secondly, the gospel means Christ has covered the shameful exposure of sin in your life. This is the word atonement, and you need to just memorize that word. Atonement. In the Old Testament, atonement literally meant covering. There is not a shadow of doubt in my mind that as Moses tells this story of what happened with Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, this is exactly what Moses wants us to think. He wants us to think of the atoning sacrifice that covers the sin. And let me give you even more exciting news, because what God covered in the Old Covenant, He removed in the New. It's not just that He covered it like that clothing over a naked father. He does away with it. Your sin is gone. Your shame, your reproach, the humiliation that sin has brought you down to, God takes it away in Christ. And then lastly, the gospel means that Christ will ultimately bring salvation and blessing to all the nations of the earth. And I alluded to this just a moment ago, but in blessing His two sons who had done right, the blessing is passed upon Shem, who is the father of the Hebrew people, through whom the Messiah would come. And Noah says, probably not even realizing what kind of blessing he's saying, Japheth, your blessing will come if and when you dwell in the tents of Shem. And it foreshadows a mystery that's taught in the New Testament that Gentiles, the children of Japheth, and even the children of Ham, are blessed in the Messiah of Israel. Ephesians 3:6, Gentiles are fellow heirs, members of the same body, and partakers of the promise in Christ Jesus through the gospel. You know, there'll be times in your life, if you're anything like me, and if you're at all honest with yourself, that you are overwhelmed with your own bent towards sin. Something just springs up on you and catches you off guard. And instead of turning away from something shameful, you want to enjoy that. Whether it's someone else's gain, someone else's profit they got in a wrong way, or a picture on the internet, or, I mean, there are 1,000 different things where you want to not turn away from sin. You want to enjoy it. You want to look at it. You want to live out something through it. You want to exploit other people. But like Noah, that something that you give yourself to is bringing you to shame right now, whether you realize it or not. And if you don't realize it, it's because your perceptions are already numbed by the intoxicating effect of that idol. Just like you don't have to be drunk to be a little numb to what the alcohol is doing in your body. It's kind of the same way with all of our idols that bring us to shame. But again, you don't have to be a slave to your shame or a slave to your sin. Because as I close here, this is truth for each of our lives, that we are more like Noah and more like Gollum than we care to admit most of the time. But if Christ has come in the gospel and broken the intoxicating power of that sin, then you don't have to serve it. You don't have to be intoxicated by it or drunken by it. And then as others sin against you, or you see the sin of others, again, remembering that Christ Himself does not exploit our sin, but Christ covers our sin once and for all by washing it away in His blood. It's an illustration of what we who have received that grace ought to be doing with each other. Not holding things against other people, not using it to exploit them, but saying, if God, who is perfect, can cover my sin and wash it away, can atone for it, why in the world would I not turn and do this to my fellow man, fellow woman, children?